So I'm starting off this series about Sangharakshita, his life and his work. There's a wee picture of him on the shrine, which you've probably seen before. And we thought it would be a good time to do this because he's going to be 90 in August. And gosh, that's a milestone, isn't it? And, you know, he came along, he found out he was a Buddhist when he was 16. So the maths are 74 years knowing he was a Buddhist. It's not bad, is it? So I'm going to talk a little bit about my own kind of connection with him, and then something about one of his teachings that's had a big effect on me. So my history is that I came along to a beginner's Buddhist retreat run by the LBC in 1988, Christmas 1988. And I went to that retreat because I was working with somebody who at the time I wasn't very close to, a woman called Mudita Shri, who was ordained, I think, in 89. So when we were talking about it, she wasn't actually ordained. And I was a bit disillusioned with life, fed up with having no boyfriend. And I was just saying to her, oh, God, I'd even go on a Buddhist retreat if there was one going. But you don't celebrate Christmas, do you? I mean, how ignorant, I think, now. Of course you don't celebrate. She said, oh, there might be a retreat. She was very laid back. Some people might have heard this before. She said, oh, I think there might be a retreat, she said. And I said, oh, it'd probably be booked up by now, because it was very getting close to Christmas. And she was again like, oh, I think there might be some spaces. I'll bring in a form, she said. So she brought the form in the next day, kind of sort of stood with me while I filled it in, wrote out a check, and then said, oh, I'm just going to lunch, I could post that for you. And I mean, I really didn't pick up on her interest at all. It was just, okay, you know. Probably be good to get away from Christmas, get away from eating too much, have some vegetarian food, do some yoga. That was my intention. Maybe learn to meditate. That was my interest, I suppose. I thought that would be good for me. So I just got a lot more than I bargained for, as you can imagine. And so my first experience of Bhante, Sangharakshita, we call him Bhante, which means revered teacher, was listening to a cassette-taped talk on this retreat. You wouldn't do that these days, probably. So we're all sitting around a little cassette recorder listening to this man's voice. Quite a strange voice, I thought. Those of you that might have heard him for the first time think, it's a bit strange, that voice. I think it was a bit, actually, that he had a bit of an Indian accent. He was very precise in his diction, his pronunciation. He never said or he just spoke. I can't remember what he was talking about at all, but that retreat just set me on a path, which I haven't really looked back from since that time. So I was very involved around the LBC, the London Buddhist Centre in East London in those days. And at that time, the late 80s and the early 90s, Bhante lived upstairs in his own flat. He was quite well. He used to get his lunch every day from the Cherry Orchard restaurant, which was just downstairs. And he'd often be walking in Victoria Park on his own in the afternoon. So I might be cycling across the park and there he would be, and I'd be going, hello, Bhante, and, you know, cycling on. So he was just there. He didn't know me, and I didn't really know him, but he was around. He did lots of book launches at that time, because a lot of these books were coming out. Every few months another book would come out. And he came to our days, FWO days, he came to Order days, he gave talks. And the first time I met him was in January 93, when I was about to go off to India for 4 months on this exciting excursion for me. I'd always wanted to go backpacking in India before I was a Buddhist, but this was even more important because I was going to go and visit the Buddhist sites. But I was quite trepidatious, and so I went to see him. I remember expressing some fear and, you know, And he just kind of dismissed my fear. It's nothing to be afraid, you know, there's no fear, nothing to be afraid of. And I realised afterwards, I said to him, well, it's all right for you, Bante, which sounded a bit like the sort of thing I might say to my mum, you know. And she says, you'll be all right. It's all right for you. I've got to go and do it. And I wanted him to be sympathetic, but he wasn't particularly. So I've met him since then, obviously, a couple of more times, one-to-one, and we also met him. I was working at Tiruvannamalai when he came to put Dada Rinpoche's ashes in the stupa, and he stayed with us for a few days. And then, some of you will remember, he came to Croydon to do Desert Island Discs. And that was Sue Bolton's idea, who was a mitra around here at that time. She arranged the whole thing and she interviewed him. It's great. I'm sure it'll be on Video Sangha, because it was recorded as a video, so most people can't watch videos anymore. That was a really fun evening, actually. So there's lots of those early memories of him, and I just wonder if what other people's first memories of Bante were. If you have any, just having a little pause to think about your own first impressions of him and your first memories of him. Okay, so I'm going to move on now to talking about the teaching that had the biggest impression on me when I first heard it. And that was the Bodhisattva Ideal series that Bante gave as talks that were taped in 1969. And, I didn't listen to those tapes because by then they'd been printed into little booklets, not this one, but just little booklets of the talks. And I really made a very strong heart connection to the Bodhisattva ideal, which is the wish to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings, put briefly. I think I connected to it because of my childhood idealism as being brought up as a Catholic. And from a very young age, we were told about children in Africa that didn't have God in their lives, poor things. And that we would save money for them to be rescued for God. And whilst you know, it's a bit of a dodgy perhaps teaching that we don't do anymore, but I think it just really engendered in me from a very young age a feeling that there were people around who didn't have what I had and are also, you know, deprived, hungry, all sorts of things. So I think I connected to it on a kind of childish level, if you like, in my heart, and took it very literally that I could be a bodhisattva who would save all beings. And at the time I was working as a social worker in Woolwich, South London, South East London, and I used to talk in Mitra study. I remember talking about it was slightly a joke, but I also had, it was quite serious as well, that I wanted to be the Bodhisattva of Woolwich, because I thought Woolwich was such in a bad way that it needed a Bodhisattva all to itself. So it was a sort of magical childhood magic in a way. And when I was reading this again, I found a little bit that Bante talks about himself when he first found out about the Bodhisattva ideal. He said he was more after he'd originally discovered it. He read the Avatamsaka Sutra, and he said that he read the work repeatedly, and its picture of the infinitely wise and boundlessly compassionate Bodhisattva made a deep impression on him. And reading a book by Shantideva a few years later, he was saying that he was attracted to the Bodhisattva ideal more than ever so strongly, in fact, that attraction is far too weak a word for what I then felt. The truth was that I was thrilled, exhilarated, uplifted, and inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal. And I think that he passed that on to me in those days. So, later on, after I was ordained, I was studying the Bodhisattva ideal with other order members in a teaching seminar. We did Mitra study seminars. And I kind of realized that I'd taken this ideal literally. Because there's much more from Bhante's seminars in this book than there ever was in the original talks. And also, his thinking had moved on, and he was talking about, of course, nobody can literally save all sentient beings. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but I did sort of think I could, or that, you know, a Bodhisattva could. And it was really shocking when I realised that it was more of a metaphor, I suppose. So there's a few bits in here that I wanted to read out where he says that. So apparently the Bodhisattva volunteers for sojourns of millions of years in various hells for the sake of helping just one living being. But can we really imagine ourselves doing that? He says. When the texts speak of a Bodhisattva in this way, it makes more sense to think that they're referring to some sort of cosmic trend or recognizing the existence of a potential for enlightenment even under the most unfavorable circumstances. So he says it doesn't seem at all practical to us, that it's more practical to take the Bodhisattva as representing a universal, even omnipresent spiritual energy at work in the universe. We can't literally think of being a Bodhisattva, but we can be open to the ideal, aspiring to be a channel for that energy within our own particular sphere. So that's kind of more like the description of the bodhicitta arising in us, which is the manifestation of enlightenment for the sake of all. So I wanted to talk, sort of give you a little run through of the Bodhisattva ideal series through the six paramitas, which are the practice of the Bodhisattva. So the Bodhisattva takes a vow to save all sentient beings and to create the conditions for the arising of the bodhicitta. And I think Bhante took this vow. I don't know if other people remember that. I couldn't find it anywhere, but I think he took the Bodhisattva vow and the Bodhisattva precepts from Dada Rinpoche. I couldn't find the reference to it, but I thought that was the case. Dada Rinpoche was a very influential teacher of his in Kalimpong when he was in India. So, the vow, you take the vow, I wouldn't encourage anybody. I don't mean you. The Bodhisattva in training will take the vow. And the practice is the practice of the six paramitas. And the good thing about this list of paramitas is that we can all practice them at our own level. So paramita means perfection, so the perfection of these six practices. But we can all take them at our own level. And the first two, Bhante groups them in pairs of two. So the first two are dana and sila. So dana is generosity, sila is ethics. And that he talks loads about dana, about generosity. It being a very basic Buddhist practice that if you can't do anything else, you can't meditate, you're not very good at chanting, you know, you can't give talks, whatever, you can give something. You can give something. So what can you give? What can you do? If you can't do anything else, you can give. And who do you give to? You give to everyone, all of the time. So he then talks a bit about a list. He has a list of the headings of what we can give. So we can give, obviously, we can give practical help. We can give food, clothing, shelter. We can make people a cup of tea. Even. We can give a bit of our money away to charities or to somebody that needs it more than us. And we can give qualities. I like this one. He talks about fearlessness. Give the quality of fearlessness. And I know from my own experience when I was training for ordination that the order members that I knew encouraged me by their example. And we can do that too. If we're making an effort spiritually, our confidence can help others. As long as we're being authentic and not sort of pretending. So however much fearlessness you have, it might be just a tiny bit, but you can pass that on. The next thing is culture and education, which has a refining effect on people. And I was thinking about Jenny Roberts, who was here a few weeks ago, talking about Karenar and how they set up hostels for young people to make the most of education so that they can stay in the hostels and go to school. Giving them a culture and education they would never have got if they'd stayed in their own little slum homes. Next one's a bit tricky. It's life and limb. So probably may not be called upon to give life and limb for the Dharma, but it's quite an interesting thought, isn't it? You know, I think in my this is another sort of over-inspired, idealistic state. I remember thinking, if somebody was going to assassinate Bhante, I'd jump in front of him, the gun, and take the bullet. I mean, would I? I don't know. But I used to think like that sometimes. Yeah. So the next one is our merits, transferring our merits. We know the transference of merits from the puja. And while we might think, do we really know what that means, to give away our merits? What does that really mean? We can take it sort of metaphorically, and at least it's the idea of it does help you to, perhaps it guards against the feelings of grandeur. If you think you've done something really good, if you just think about giving it away, stops us getting above ourselves, I suppose. So then the last gift that is on the list is the gift of the Dharma. And this is what we're doing here, isn't it, in the Buddhist Centre here and in Buddhist Centres all over the place. And I think Bhante himself is the best example I can think of someone who's just devoted his whole life to giving the Dharma to as many people as he could. And sharing that with others so that then they can go out and spread the Dharma. And that's what the Buddha talked about as well. You know, as soon as he had disciples around him, he told them to go out and spread the Dharma for the welfare of the many, for the good of the many. And I think with Bhante, you know, he's a bit of a recluse by nature, and he could have stayed in Kalimpong where he was having quite a nice time teaching the Dharma and meditating, writing poetry, writing books, writing articles, surrounded as he was by teachers that had come out of Tibet. But he came over here thinking to stay a few months or a couple of years, and then because it didn't work out with the English Sangha Trust, he decided to set up a new movement. And he said somewhere in his memoirs that he wasn't the most suitable person to do this. And somehow, he doesn't even feel he did do it. It just sort of did itself somehow. And maybe that's a flavour of that bodhisattva, the bodhicitta working through him. So, yeah, we give to all, we give to friends and foe, and we give because it counteracts greed as much as anything else. Lots of other reasons. So instead of seeing ourselves as an island, we see ourselves as being connected to people. And that leads then into the sila side of these two things, the ethics, the precepts, which Bhante talks about as being more self-regarding, which I've always had a problem with, because I suppose I've always thought of being ethical as being for other people. But actually, if you take the Buddhist teaching seriously, it is also it's purifying us, isn't it? We say that in the five precepts. We say, with open-handed generosity, I purify my body. So in purifying ourselves ethically, we are naturally helping others. So, but we are doing it, hopefully, for ourselves as well. And we have to remember, of course, that these precepts are training principles. So they exist to help us to get closer to reality. They're not commandments. They are the expression of how a Buddha would act. And we do our best with them when we remember. And if we want to, we can always tell our friends when we fail to keep the precepts, so that we can let go of that. So in this part of the this lecture, Bhante talks about three areas. He just chose these three areas. Eating mindfully. He talks about eating mindfully. He also talks elsewhere about not talking when you're eating, so that you don't get distracted and eat too much. About being a vegetarian, which is a very strong part of Buddhist practice. So it's eating, working. He talks about working, and the last series we had was all about work, so we've had quite a lot about working as a right livelihood, in some sort of right livelihood. And then the third one is marriage. He brings in marriage. Being ethical in, I suppose, being ethical in a sexual relationship, quite hard sometimes. But he also talks about it not being a legal commitment, not being a sacrament. You make your own, you know, you kind of get together and make your own rules, really, in Buddhist marriage. You don't have to stick to external rules. You know, if you want to have two partners, you can, as long as they're both happy about it. And it's between consenting adults. So that's dana and sila, generosity and ethics. There's a bit of a rush through the paramita, but I think some of it's familiar anyway, but I'm just... pause. Time. And move on swiftly to the next two, shanti and virya. Kshanti has three translations, forbearance, tolerance, and receptivity. So it's a kind of, I think these two do kind of go together quite well in a sort of a two sides of the same thing, because virya is energy in pursuit of the good. So you have a more kind of passive, if you like, not the right word, passive, and more active two practices. So with forbearance, I think shanti, it doesn't seem so exciting somehow as virya. Virya, you know, let's go out and transform the world. But actually, shanti is also a very important practice. He talks about three areas of forbearance towards external circumstances that we can't change. And that's not really, I was just thinking about things like sitting in a traffic jam, you know, kind of getting in a tizzy about it, and not getting things your own way. You can't change them. It's just happened. It's just circumstances. There's traffic lights. There's roadworks. Even though there's nobody doing any work, there's roadworks. Be, you know, practice forbearance. Towards our own body, and I know... several of us have to work with this, and I've had an experience of it this week where my back got really, really painful, and I just got into a state of horrible, well, I suppose anxiety, thinking, oh no, is this how my back's going to be now forever? It's so painful, I can't move, I can't swim anymore. You know, just going on into, this is my life forever. But actually, it is part of the aging process. We do have to accept that as we get older, pain will arise. It might have arisen when we were quite young. We might have all sorts of things to work with our body, and they may not show. I think that's always a bit difficult. If you don't look as if you're hobbling, people are not always that sensitive. But we have to be sensitive towards us. This is the first stage of the metta bhavana. We have to be sensitive towards ourselves and our body, and kind. I think probably it's harder sometimes to be kind to ourselves. And forbearance towards other people, just generally, just everywhere, wherever you see them, always. Plenty of opportunity. They're always there, aren't they? Especially if you live in a place like Croydon or anywhere in London, really, there's always people to be practicing forbearance with. The next translation is tolerance. Just a very, very short bit. Just being clear about our own beliefs. We don't have to sort of be aggressive about what we believe in, but we need to be tolerant of others' views, but we don't have to. I think there's a way in which you can kind of go over the top and think that all views are equally valuable. That's not a Buddhist belief. The Buddha would have said, well, you know, believing in God is not really that helpful, a creator God. It's best not to believe in creator God. But, you know, be kind to those that do, and just stick with your own beliefs. Tolerance has been a Buddhist virtue over the years. Unfortunately, not everywhere these days. There's a the Sri Lankan Buddhists waged war on the Tamils for a long time, with lots of really awful things happening. And in Burma, of course, they profess to be Buddhists, don't they? But they're not very kind to their population. So we're, unfortunately, Buddhism can't say, oh, we're the tolerant religion. And you Christians and Muslims and all the rest of you are not, because it's not true, unfortunately, everywhere. The last translation of Kshanti is receptivity. Not always easy to be receptive. You might find out that something you've held dear, I suppose a bit like me holding dear to being a bodhisattva one day, literally, saving all beings. I had to be receptive to that being a bit grandiose, I suppose you could say. It wasn't going to happen. There's a couple of bits I wanted to read from here. I'm going to be dipping into this book. I hope that's okay. Just keep reading little bits to you. But Bhante puts it so well. I can't really do better. Kshanti clearly involves a lack of that kind of pride, an intellectual humility, the recognition that you don't know everything. Spiritual receptivity is of the utmost importance. Without it, spiritual progress simply cannot be maintained. We should be ready, if necessary, to give up whatever we've learned so far, to give up whatever we have become so far. And then he goes on to say something that might strike you as a bit strange. He says, how can one become spiritually receptive in this way? Well, for a start, one can pray. I like that. You know, you may think, well, Buddhists, they don't pray, do they? Who are they going to pray to? But he says, you know, if you experience a desire to pray, there's no need to stop yourself on the strength of this rational understanding. You know, being rational about the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, they're not really there. Who am I praying to? Don't worry about it. If it's a genuine feeling, don't suppress it. He says, my reply is always that if one feels like praying, one should go ahead and do it and work out the theology later. If it's a genuine feeling, don't repress it. Don't suppress it. So, yeah, if prayer was something that meant a lot to you in your past and you feel you had to give it away and not have it anymore, there's no need to. Are you still with me? Okay, virya. Energy in pursuit of the good. Dun, 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 dun. So, superwoman. Energy. It's often not available, is it? Because we let it slip away. We waste it. We spend too much time on our computers or whatever, watching silly television. So it leaks away. Wasted. If you could see it, it'd be interesting, wouldn't it? If you could see your energy dribbling out of your feet as you're watching another episode of some EastEnders or something, I don't know. You'd just kind of stop, wouldn't you? You'd be so shocked. You'd just sort of think, no, stop. I'm going to do something worthwhile. So sometimes that's what happens. Sometimes it's blocked. Sometimes because of our childhood experiences or whatever, our energy is blocked and it's not available to us then. We don't really know where to find it. Sometimes we need to unravel those psychological difficulties, don't we? Sometimes it's coarse and unrefined. So meditation is obviously a good way to help free that energy, because we're integrating ourselves, aren't we, in mindfulness of breathing, in the metta bhavana. We're encouraging that loving kindness to develop in ourselves. So that's one of the good things that meditation gives us, especially in the beginning of our spiritual life when we've perhaps not done it in the past. Helps to free up our energy. And puja. Puja can help to transform our energy. Because the bodhisattvas, the story goes that the bodhisattvas, they just play. They don't have to, it doesn't seem like work to them. They're just jumping, they're just like elephants jumping from one pool to the other, refreshing themselves in their work, just endlessly refreshing themselves. So those two practices, kshanti and virya, are sometimes looked on as the monkey or the kitten thingy. So the monkey, you know, the monkey hangs on to mum. The monkey has to be active. So the monkey's got virya, if you like. Whereas the kitten kind of goes passive and gets picked up by the scruff of its neck by mum. So the kitten is more like receptive, kshanti. But we need both, don't we? We need both. So you need to be kittens and monkeys at different times. And we kind of need to see where we're stronger and where we're weaker. You know, what do we need to... I think it's good to see these things as pairs, because we can then see which we're stronger at and which needs to be encouraged more. So the last two, there's not a lot to say about, really. Samadhi and pranya. Bhante says quite a lot about it. He says a lot about meditation, about the dhyanas. So samadhi means meditation, and pranya, wisdom. But these two are really not separate. They're completely interwoven. You can't have one without the other. One is the expression of the other, in fact. Got a little quote here. 163. What is this? Right. I mean, but earlier on in the text, when Bhante is talking about the dhyanas in meditation, he says, always makes me laugh, sometimes used to make me cry, as soon as one goes to meditate, whether in a shrine room or a corner of one's own room, as soon as one sits down and closes one's eyes, one should go straight into dhyana. It should be as natural and easy as that. In fact, if we led a truly human life, it would be. But he does go on to say, well, he knows this doesn't happen. So most meditation exercises don't lead directly to higher states of consciousness. They simply help us to remove the obstacles. The Bodhisattva, of course, practices not just meditation, but the dhyanas, paramita, for the perfection of meditation. In other words, she practices meditation not for peace of mind, though that certainly came, not to get to heaven, though even that may come if desired. She practices meditation as one aspect of the path which will lead one day to enlightenment for the benefit of all. So there you see, he's gone back on this, on himself, and he's saying it will lead to the enlightenment of all. So here he says that the two interconnected. 169, did I just read that? Sorry. They are interconnected, meditation and wisdom. The lamp, it's like the lamp and the light. One is the expression of the other. So once the light, the lamp's a light, it's the expression of the lamp. There's a lot more one could say about all that, but I'm going to stop and read something which I think gives us a taste of the bodhicitta arising. It's quite a long reading. It's from one of Bhante's memoirs, and it's you may have heard it before because it's a wonderful reading. It's, it goes back to December 1956, which is a very important day. Bhante was in Bombay a few days before. He was in fact, he was with this Christian guy called Dr. Mehta, who he used to spend time with, because Dr. Mehta used to commune with God. And Bhante found it quite helpful. He didn't commune with God, but he found the practice quite helpful with Dr. Mehta. So he said he decided he had to go. He needed to leave, and he didn't know why. He just knew he had to be on his way. So I'll read from there. So sorry to part from my God-guided friend. I did not allow his forebodings to disturb me. And my predominant feeling as I caught the overnight train to Nagpur was one of satisfaction, even relief, that at last I was acting on the knowledge that it was essential for me to be on my way. Why it was essential for me to be on my way, I did not know. Dr. Mehta had predicted that all my plans would come to nothing, but it was not because I had plans that I needed to carry out immediately that it was essential for me to be on my way. I was on my way simply because it was essential that I should be on my way. I was on my way to Calcutta, where I would be editing the next issue of the Mahabodhi Journal, and I would break my journey in Nagpur in order to make the acquaintance of the newly converted Buddhists who had invited me to spend a few days with them and deliver some lectures. But it was not because I had to do these things immediately that it was essential for me to be on my way. I could just as easily have edited the next issue of the Mahabodhi Journal in Bombay, and just as easily have given my Nagpur lectures 2 or 3 weeks later. I was on my way because it was, I knew, essential for me to be on my way. So why it was essential, I did not yet know. I arrived in Nagpur at 1 o'clock. Less than an hour later, when I was still settling into my new quarters, there was a sudden commotion in the yard outside, and a few seconds later, 3 or 4 members of the Indian Buddhist Society burst into the little outhouse. Baba Saheb was dead. He had died in Delhi the previous night. This is Dr. Mehta.
The bearers of these dire tidings were not only in a state of deep shock, but utterly denying. They were barely able to tell me that the society's downtown office was being besieged by thousands of grief-stricken people who, knowing my presence in Nagpur, were demanding that I should come and speak to them. Obviously, it would be impossible for me to address so many people without a microphone and loudspeakers. I therefore told my visitors to organise a proper condolence meeting. The condolence meeting was held in the Kasturgeon Park, which was little more than a large open space, part of which was occupied by a small pavilion. Roads apparently debouched into it from a number of directions. For on my arrival there at 7 o'clock, by which time night had fallen, it was the dark centre of a gigantic wheel, the golden spokes of which were formed by the lighted candles carried by the long columns of mourners who were converging on the place from all over the city. As the columns entered the park, I saw that the men, women and children carrying the candles were all clad in white, the same white that only 7 weeks ago they had worn for the conversion ceremony. Whether on account of their demoralised state, or because there was not enough time, the organisers of the meeting had done little more than rig up a microphone and loudspeakers. There was no stage, and apart from a petromax or two, no illumination, other than that provided by the thousands of candles. By the time I rose to speak, standing on the seat of the rickshaw, and with someone holding a microphone in front of me, about 100,000 people had assembled. Under normal circumstances, I would have been the last speaker, but on this occasion I was the third. The fact of things turned out, I was the only speaker. Though some five or six of Ambedkar's most prominent local supporters, one by one, attempted to pay tribute to their departed leader, they were so overcome by emotion, after uttering only a few words, they burst into tears and had to sit down. Their example was contagious. When I started to speak, the whole vast gathering was weeping. And sobs and groans filled the air. In the cold blue light of the petromax, I could see grey-haired men rolling in avenues of grief at my feet. Though deeply moved by the sight of so much anguish and despair, I realised that for me at least, this was no time to indulge in emotion. And Ambedkar's followers had received a terrible shock. They had been Buddhists for only 7 weeks, and now their leader, in whom their trust was total, and whose guidance in the difficult days ahead they had been relying, had been snatched away. Poor and illiterate, as the vast majority of them were, and faced by the unrelenting hostility of the caste Hindus, they did not know which way to turn, and there was a possibility that the whole movement of conversion to Buddhism would come to a halt, or even collapse. I therefore delivered a vigorous and stirring speech in which, after extolling the greatness of Ambedkar's achievement, I exhorted my audience to continue the work he had so gloriously begun, and bring it to a successful conclusion. Baba Saheb was not dead, but alive, to the extent that they were faithful to the ideals for which he stood, and for which he had quite literally sacrificed himself. He lived on in me. This speech, which lasted for an hour or more, was not without effect. And Ambedkar's stricken followers began to realise that it was not the end of the world, that there was a future for them, even after their beloved Saheb's death, and that the future was not altogether devoid of hope. While I was speaking, I had an extraordinary experience. Above the crowd, there hung an enormous presence. Whether the presence was Ambedkar's departing consciousness, hovering over the heads of his followers, or whether it was the collective product of their thoughts at that time of crisis and trial, I do not know. But it was as real to me as the people I was addressing. In the course of the next 4 days, I visited practically all the ex-untouchable localities of Nagpur, of which there must have been several dozen, and addressing nearly 30 mass meetings, besides initiating about 30,000 people into Buddhism and delivering lectures at the Nagpur University. As I wrote to Dina, like a friend, from Calcutta a few weeks later, I think I can say without vanity that I created a tremendous impression. Dr. Ambedkar's followers told me that they felt my being there at that critical juncture was a miracle, and that I had saved Nagpur for Buddhism. Had I not been there, there is no knowing what would have happened. At first, people felt that the end of the world had come, but after listening to my speeches, which were very strong indeed, they felt full of hope and courage and determined to work for the spread of Buddhism. On the last day of my visit, I gave no less than 11 lectures. The last was held at 1:30 in the morning when 15,000 people were converted to Buddhism. My own spiritual experience during this period was most peculiar. I felt that I was not a person, but an impersonal force. At one stage, I was working literally without any thought, just as one does in samadhi. Also, I felt hardly any tiredness, certainly not at all what one would have expected from such a tremendous strain. When I left Nagpur, I felt quite fresh and restless.